pleased tonight to facilitate this forum on opening night of the Great Tennessee Monkey Trial. The title of this forum is The Scopes Trial, A Continuing Controversy. The panelists will focus on the following question: what is going on in our world today that causes this topic to remain so politically charged? Now, by this topic, we of course mean the relationship between evolution and religion in the public school classroom. That this topic remains the subject of considerable debate is just beyond question. In recent weeks, as many of you know, the issue has been featured prominently in the print media, from Time Magazine to the New York Times, from USA Today to the Tennessean. The issue has surfaced in the White House and on television's West Wing. The topic is simply hard to miss. The debate between evolution and creationism emerged in a Tennessee courtroom decades ago, and you will see it replayed tonight. Since then, much has happened. The Supreme Court prohibited the elimination of evolution from the science curriculum. It prohibited the teaching of creationism alongside evolution in the science classroom. Lower courts have prohibited the reading or posting of disclaimers about evolution. Today, the debate has taken a new turn. It now focuses on intelligent design. Some believe that natural forces of mutation and selection set in motion the process by which all species of plants and animals develop over time. But others believe that life is simply too complex to be explained by random events, and that an intelligent designer set in motion the process. Supporters of intelligent design seek to include criticism of evolution in public school science standards, or they seek to include consideration of intelligent design itself in the science curriculum. For example, a school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, has mandated a statement offering intelligent design alongside scientific explanations of the origin of life as a precursor to lessons in biological evolution. This case is now before a lower court, and soon it may find its way before the Supreme Court, a court whose membership itself has changed and continues to change in recent weeks. As a community, we have an opportunity to set the issue of science and religion in context. Tonight, we intend to address the following questions. What does history teach? From a sociological perspective, what continues to fuel this topic? From a legal standpoint, is it permissible to teach the controversy? Where do we go from here? I now turn to the panelists, who will each introduce themselves before offering their remarks. Unfortunately, time is such that we may no longer have time for questions, but we will take it from here.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Charles Israel. I'm an associate professor of history at Auburn University. And I think my role here is as a historian, and I've done some work on the history before Scopes, looking at the environment of Tennessee and the religious and educational and cultural environment of the state. And so what I see my role doing tonight is to say a few things about how did we get to Dayton, the sort of center of this play that you're going to be witnessing, and then turn it over to the other panelists who can tell us a lot more about where we've gone since Dayton, life after Scopes. So I offer three contexts for getting us to Dayton in that hot summer of 1925. A concern about education, the question why evolution, why is that the major issue that angered folks or made such a polarizing environment? And then finally, how does it go from a cultural debate to a legal one? So first, concerns about public education. Public education was a relative latecomer in much of the American South. Tennessee prided itself, and particularly Nashville, as the Athens of the South. But for the most part, public schooling, even a very rudimentary form, was a post-Civil War entity. And even then, you really don't see public high schools spread throughout the state outside of urban areas until the 1920s.
1921, before you have one in every county of the state. Tennessee evangelicals were reluctant in the 1870s and 1880s to accept these public schools, fearing that they might in some way infringe on their cultural authority, on the ability of parents and churches to explain the world to their children. But gradually they grew to accept the schools, in part out of a recognition that they alone could not deal with the mass numbers of students, white and black, looking for an education in the late 19th century. But they accepted the public schools on a couple of premises. First, they believed that these public schools would be responsive to the conditions of the existing community, that they would reflect community standards, although they didn't necessarily use that terminology at the point. They also felt that any shortcoming in these public schools, schools that would be, though they said, would reflect community standards, these community standards that they expected were very much Protestant, probably evangelical, and that was the expected norms. But any lack of religion or any lack of denominational religion in these public schools could be corrected, they suggested, in one of two places, in the home or church, they thought of both of them very similarly, or, most importantly, to many Tennessee evangelicals, in their denominational colleges, that any sort of errors in the public school could be corrected once they got to college. Since we're, in a sense, being hosted, at least the series is being hosted by Vanderbilt, I should say, it played an important role in this, that Vanderbilt was seen as, in some ways, the crown jewel of evangelical education in the late 19th century. It plays a role in this, in that Vanderbilt, in a very sort of nasty and public split, or at least that's the way it was perceived, a split from the Methodist Church, the Southern Methodist Church in 1914. So many people who had been looking to evangelical denominational education as the solution all of a sudden started looking around in 1914 and saying, oh, well, if we can't trust that, what do? We must pay more attention to the public schools. So that's the first context. Public schools are spreading, and now there's a new concern. Well, we don't have another choice. We need to be concerned about what's going on in the schools. Secondly, why evolution? The two contexts here would be World War I and William Jennings Bryan. Bryan certainly a key figure in the play that's coming up tonight. Bryan was the Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson. He had been at least three times candidate for President of the United States. He resigned his office as Secretary of State during World War I as a pacifist, fearing that Wilson's foreign policy was going to engage America in World War I. Like many Americans, he recoiled at the horror that the war revealed, the killing, the speed of killing, and whatnot. And he looked for a cause. And the cause that he came to ultimately was one that it was German aggression. And what caused German aggression? He said it was that the German education system had dethroned God, had taken God out of the classroom, and had instead replaced him with Nietzsche's version of survival of the fittest, something that he ascribed to having come from Darwin first. So it was godless German education, and the lesson that Bryan took away was the same thing could befall the United States if they were not vigilant. He found further danger of Darwin in a series of psychological studies in 1916 that suggested a correlation between greater years of education and a declining faith. That the more time you spent in college, the less likely you were to profess a faith in God. And so Bryan put these two together and said, well, that's the problem, or that's the key to the problem, is dealing with Darwinian evolution, and particularly the education of it. So the last part, how does this become a legal problem? Because Darwin starts out on the lecture circuit. He goes to the Chautauqua circuit and he says, here, we need to be wary of Darwinian education. Parents teach your children well. He gets the idea from our neighbors to the north in Kentucky. In 1921, Kentucky State Baptist, the mission board, proposes the idea that the legislature should outlaw the teaching of evolution. Bryan, who's living in Florida at this point, takes the fastest train he can to Frankfurt, speaks before the legislature endorsing the law, a law that ultimately fails in 1922. It comes up a few votes short. But the genie is out of the bottle, and Bryan and others will campaign tirelessly over the next couple of years in a variety of states, in Florida and Oklahoma, but for our context tonight, Tennessee. 1923, Tennessee debates, but ultimately does not pass an anti-evolution law, 1925, it does. A law that's proposed by a primitive Baptist lay minister, a representative, two-term representative from Macon County, not all that far away from here, a man by the name of John Washington Butler. So the law is passed in the summer of 1925. Austin Peay, the governor, signs it and says, this is just a symbolic gesture. I don't think anything will come of this. I have my suspicions he knew otherwise, but there were many forces in order to try and make something happen of this. The town of Dayton, a town that had seen its best days behind it in some ways, saw this as a chance to put itself on the map, to attract publicity, and certainly it did. It was successful at getting a lot of press attention, a lot of people to show up. The ACLU, coming out of World War I, looking for a new legitimacy, trying to find its ways in the post-World War I era, took out advertisements in a number of Tennessee newspapers promising to pay for anyone willing to challenge the law. And so the town boosters in Dayton decide, hey, here's our chance at success. They draft John Scopes into the plot. He agrees to stand trial, and then the rest becomes history. And you will see, hopefully, a very good version of what that is. And I'll turn it to the others, I think, to really give us from 1925, because I think that's really where we get the very interesting part of what's going on today.
Thank you, Charles. My name is Vaughn Lee Gay. I'm chair of religion at Vanderbilt. I'm also... How's that? My name is Vaughn Lee Gay. I'm chair of religious studies at Vanderbilt, and also a member of a group talking about science and religion for about 3 years. And so this controversy has animated me and others to take quite seriously tonight's performance and this panel. Is the controversy a matter of fools resisting science? I don't think so, because the issue for Scopes and the issue for intelligent design is a religious issue, and that is, it is about the origins and nature of human beings. Anti-evolutionists do not dispute the origins of plants or microbes. They dispute the origins of human beings, of persons. The notion of human being is tied to the notion of God or the gods. In all religious reflection, we find the same question. What are we? How did our almost infinite capacities for thought, change, and domination come to be? Imbued with powers beyond other animals, humans are too faulty to be considered gods in themselves. Yet the idea of God appears in all human cultures. It names the other pole of human being. God realizes our imperfect nature. Welded together, the idea of God and human being provoke questions answered by stories. These stories tell us who we are, what we should do, and what we may hope for at our death or at the end of history. For Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Genesis provides a way to judge all competing accounts. When Darwinists challenged the naive worldview embedded in Genesis, numerous persons felt that the ethical core of civilization itself was at stake, or as Charles just said, World War I suggested that we could murder human beings on scales never before thought. These are not foolish concerns. By 1935, 35 American states had enacted laws using so-called eugenic theory. Persons deemed mentally ill, retarded, habitual criminals, and epileptics were castrated. In Summer for the Gods, an account of the Scopes trial, a distinguished historian, Edward Larson, cites George Hunter, a high school textbook author. Hunter wrote this sentence: "If such people were lower animals, we would probably kill them off to prevent them from spreading. However, humanity will not allow this, but we do have the remedy of separating the sexes in asylums and other places and in various ways preventing intermarriage and the possibility of perpetuating such a low and degenerate race." Nazi authorities cited American eugenic legislation when they took the murder option after 1933. William Jennings Bryan, the politician savaged in the movie Inherit the Wind, argued against eugenics and linked it to Darwinism. Ignorant of how science works, Bryan aligned himself with its repression, and in that way, we cannot agree with him. Yet Bryan's anxiety is understandable. By linking human being to God, Genesis elevates humans. When Adam names the animals, his progeny assume dominion and singularity. Human beings are sacred in themselves. Each has an inherent dignity. Each is an end, not a means. The debates over abortion, the death penalty, the role of religion in the founding of the United States, America's place in the world, all turn on the definition and understanding of the concept person. We see this in the Iraq War, begun almost 3 years ago. To what degree does the American Bill of Rights correspond to something that is true for all persons, for all time, and thus for Iraqis too? Is there a shared human nature, grounded on freedom and a universal ethics, that is announced in the Quran and in the Bible, both turning on the Genesis accounts? I don't know. But a war hangs in the balance, and therefore its consequences are on us as well. Will the controversy we see repeated in our time reappear? I think it has to for these reasons. Thank you.
Good evening. Can you hear me? I'm Hetty Weinberg. I'm the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Tennessee. In my office hangs a poster I received some 30 years ago commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Scopes trial. Clarence Darrow, William Jennings Bryan are seated side by side. Darrow's words are included. If today you can take a thing like evolution and make it a crime to teach it, at the next session you may ban books and the newspapers. Soon you may set Catholic against Protestant and Protestant against Protestant and try to foist your own religion upon the mind of men. After a while, with flying banners and beating drums, we are marching backwards to the glorious days of the 16th century. Darrow's words, his fears, ring true today, 80 years later, as the radical religious right mobilizes to create a sectarian, intolerant society. We are definitely in the midst of a culture war, and the radical religious right's continued attempt to thwart the teaching of evolution is an indication of that war. Presently, religious anti-evolutionists either disguise religion as science or attempt to detract from the scientific qualities of evolutionary theory. In Tennessee, we see the battles across the state. In Blount County in East Tennessee, the school board adopted a resolution on biological origins, which encourages teachers to teach the controversy in their classes and include intelligent design in the science classroom. In Shelby County, in West Tennessee, a school board member has proposed that the school system put disclaimer stickers about evolution in high school biology textbooks. For the moment, that issue has been deferred. The religious radical right continues in its pursuit of its mission to inject religion into the science classroom. Ever since the Scopes trial, opponents of the scientific theory of evolution have attempted to forbid, limit, or otherwise undermine the teaching of biological evolution in public science classrooms. Challenges have included laws or policies prohibiting the teaching of evolution, requiring teachers to make statements or disclaimers questioning the validity of the scientific theory of evolution, and requiring teachers to present anti-evolutionary views, including religious views not based on scientific evidence. The ACLU has returned to court many times since the Scopes trial to challenge these efforts to promote faith-based explanations of the origin of life in science curricula. And each time, the court has consistently ruled that the United States Constitution does not permit the teaching of religious doctrine in science classrooms. Now, I want to take the remaining moments and review some of the cases on point. Remember that between the 1920s and the early 1960s, anti-evolutionary sentiment had a subtle but pervasive influence on the teaching of biology in public schools, with the consequence being that the science textbooks avoided the topic of evolution. The legal landscape changed radically when in 1968, in Epperson versus Arkansas, the United States Supreme Court invalidated an Arkansas statute that prohibited the teaching of evolution. Arkansas had made it a misdemeanor for any teacher in any state-supported school or university to teach theory or doctrine that mankind ascended or descended from a lower order of animals, or to adopt or use in any such institution a textbook that teaches this theory. Unlike the Tennessee law from the Scopes trial, the Arkansas statute did not include direct references to the book of Genesis. The United States Supreme Court found that the statute was religiously motivated and held that the statute was unconstitutional on the grounds that the First Amendment does not permit a state to tailor curriculum based on any particular religious doctrine or sect. Following Epperson, evolution's religious opponents replaced the outright ban on evolution that the Supreme Court had invalidated with the balanced treatment statutes to require public school teachers who teach evolution to devote equal time to teaching the biblical view of creationism. However, in 1975, in Daniel V. Waters, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected this new ploy and found that the Tennessee law was just another attempt to bring religion into the science classroom. It was then that the opponents of evolution regrouped, recognizing that they could neither ban evolution nor counter it with religious instruction in public schools. They adopted a new tactic, and that was to dress up their religious beliefs in scientific-sounding language and then mandating the teaching of creation science. In 1987, the United States Supreme Court struck down Louisiana's The Balanced Treatment Act for Creation Science and Evolution Science in Public School Instruction. In Edwards v. Aguilar, the court found that by advancing the religious belief that a supernatural being created humankind, which is what is embraced by the term creation science, the act impermissibly endorses religion. The U.S. Supreme Court found that there was no secular purpose for the act. It rejected the argument that there was a secular interest in academic freedom motivating the bill. As mentioned, another way to try to remove the teaching of evolution from the classroom is to chill teachers' academic freedom. One way to do this is by the use of disclaimers, either by requiring teachers to state that evolution is a theory and not fact, or risk being summarily dismissed, or by requiring stickers on biology textbooks. The most recent case is out of the Federal District Court in Georgia. Cobb County, Georgia school districts passed a policy requiring stickers on biology textbooks with the following text: "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. No other subject in the curriculum was the object of a similar sticker." In January 2005, the Federal District Court in Georgia ruled in Selman v. Cobb County School District that the mandated sticker violated the Establishment Clause because it has the effect of endorsing religion. This case is now on appeal. The most recent tactic by the religious right for imbuing the science curriculum with religion is, as Lisa said earlier, the introduction of intelligent design. Intelligent design purports to be a scientific hypothesis that life owes its origins to a master intellect, an intelligent supernatural designer. In reality, it is an inherently religious argument opposing the scientific theory of evolution. It is a variant of the so-called creation science, which maintains that species originated through abrupt appearance in complex form. Like creation science, intelligent design is being advanced to support the religious views known as creationism, that man and other species were created by God and did not evolve from lower life forms. Last month, ACLU returned to the courtroom to argue that intelligent design is inherently a religious argument that falls outside of the realm of science. The Pennsylvania lawsuit, Kitzmiller versus Dover School System, was filed on behalf of 11 parents challenging a Dover area school board policy that requires biology teachers to present intelligent design as an alternative to the scientific theory of evolution. The Dover school system mandates that intelligent design be taught as a bona fide scientific theory of evolution in order to develop a balanced curriculum. Teachers are also required to read a statement to the ninth grade students that explains that evolution is theory, not fact, that intelligent design is an explanation of the origin of life and differs from Darwin's views, that there is an intelligent design reference book of panda and people available in the library, and that students should once again keep an open mind. To read the Dover School District briefs, one would think that there is no factual record at all, no testimony from fact witnesses, no expert testimony, no legislative history for the district's policy. Certainly, no one would guess that the record establishes that, one, the school board members describe the district's objective at public board meetings using overtly religious terms, and we see that often when we're looking at the legislative history. Two, in developing its policy, the school board did not consult any scientific resources, not one professional scientist, not one scientific organization, not even the district's own science teachers. Instead, it sought legal advice only from a religious think tank and a faith-based law firm. Three, the book of Pandas and People, to which the policy directs students, was originally written as a creationist text and was revised to use the term intelligent design only after the Supreme Court declared teaching creationism in public schools was unconstitutional. And finally, the Dover community understands that the policy is religiously inspired and is to further religious objectives. The case now is in its fourth week. The ACLU and other groups fighting this battle have just concluded their arguments, and the defense began on Monday with their arguments. The trial is scheduled to end November 4th, and for those of you who are more interested, I would urge you to go to the ACLU of Pennsylvania blog, which keeps a detailed diary and journal of what's going on. As Lisa pointed out at the beginning of the panel, this case is most likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. We can only hope that Darryl's fears are never realized, and we all need to continue to fight to ensure that we do remain a diverse religious society without government sharing its views by only directing one religion to have the platform. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Larry Crane. I'm a constitutional lawyer with the American Center for Law and Justice. Hetty and I frequently oppose each other in forums of this type, and sometimes agree on many topics, but not this one, unfortunately. History of man's quest to understand and explain the origins of life is punctuated with intolerance both from science and religion. You may recall that in your history, in 1524, a very religious man by the name of Galileo was indicted by an inquisition of the Roman Catholic Church and charged with criminal heresy for the publication of his book called The Assayer, in which he posited the Copernican theory of heliocentrism. The complaint charged Galileo's atomistic theory conflicted with an official church doctrine regarding the Eucharist, in which bread and wine are transubstantiated into the body and blood of Christ. Galileo, like John Scopes, however, was examined, only in his case, interrogated for 18 days. And only after that, when he failed to recant his scientific theory, Pope Urban VIII sentenced him to house arrest, where he remained until he died in 1642. Today, those who maintain that the Darwinist theory of evolution is the only possible explanation for the origin of life and the only one which may be discussed or debated in a public school classroom have adopted an equally intolerant position. Like Pope Urban VIII, those who proselytize a belief system which systematically excludes all other scientific explanations for the spontaneous appearance of unique species in the fossil record would silence academic freedom on the altar of strict separation of church and state. Now tonight we'll enjoy an entertaining look back at the Scopes trial in which a substitute biology teacher was convicted for merely teaching the theory of evolution. And while we can laugh at how absurd the notion is of punishing a teacher for presenting what he believes to be a viable scientific theory, there is an equally sinister movement afoot today in public schools to censor and indeed discipline those who would present equally plausible scientific challenges to some of Darwin's theories. And as a lawyer, I have represented students and teachers who have been subjected to discipline and suspension for refusing to accept as doctrine the majoritarian view that the Darwinist theory is the only permissible explanation for the origin of species. The Supreme Court has often referred to our schools as the marketplace of ideas. And if we cherish the notion that truth thrives in an atmosphere of open and robust debate, then we must also accept the principle that students and teachers do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. One competing view, which is under attack today by these censors of academic freedom, is that of intelligent design. A growing number of renowned scientists from Cambridge to Harvard, including Professors Behe and Kenyon and Thaxton and Chen and Dembski, who have published on this theory, point to specific empirical evidence of design both in biology and physics. They argue that biological organisms in particular display distinctive features which are intelligently designed systems. Their arguments are based on scientific observation and the complexity of single cells and the intricate machine-like design of these cells which defy random selection. Those who would silence this debate argue that this theory, to allow this theory to be taught in our public schools, would somehow violate the establishment clause of the First Amendment. However, unlike creationism, which relies on biblical scriptural reference for its support, design theory has no ties to any spiritual dogma or religious institution. It does not point to any sacred text or church doctrine for its justification. More to the point, however, if the mere fact that there are religious implications for a concept is enough to justify banning it being taught in our public schools, then I submit to you that we must have students cease reciting the Declaration of Independence, which itself contains the phrase, "Men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The educational point at issue in these debates is not whether design theorists are right in their scientific claims, but whether their work may be discussed at all in science classrooms in our public high schools. It is misleading to suggest, as many do, that Darwinism and design theory address two different subjects, one scientific and the other religious. Rather, both Darwinism and design theory represent competing answers to the very same question. How did living forms, with their appearance of design, arise and diversify on Earth? The freedom to debate and discuss these competing scientific theories is critical to our tradition of academic freedom in this country. As the Supreme Court recognized in the 1986 case of Edwards v. Aguilar, which Hetty made reference to, nothing in the Constitution forbids a teacher from presenting scientific alternatives to Darwinian evolution. It is a right that is already protected under academic freedom. Again, allowing an open and robust debate of competing scientific theories would serve a secular purpose of enhancing educational exploration. Conversely, to exclude the discussion of any theory except Darwinism would constitute viewpoint discrimination and would violate both the teacher and the student's right of free speech. Theories about the universe and life and humanity and where they come from invariably affect our perspectives about human nature, morality, and ultimate reality. It is naive to suggest that evolution or any competing scientific theory can be presented in an airtight religious or moral vacuum. It was wrong to silence John Scopes, but it is equally reprehensible to silence and punish those modern-day Galileos who would stand against the tide of a state-mandated educational system and say, I do not accept as dogma the notion that Darwin's theory of evolution alone answers all of the mysteries surrounding the origin of life. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is David Williams. I'm the general counsel and professor of law at Vanderbilt. And my role is to try to close and sum this up, if you like, and to answer the question, where do we go or where can we go from here? And while we only have a few minutes, what I think I would do with this is to pose some questions. I won't try to answer them, and I will leave you all to your own design and time and debate to deal with them. I think the first one is to really think about this concept of education and religion. Is it in fact true that the more educated one becomes, the less reliance, the less belief there is in religion? And what does that say about an educated society? Second, should we have the legislators in the legislation prohibit the teaching of anything? And if we do, what should they prohibit? And how do we make that decision? Third question I have is, in this debate, can there be coexistence? Why not? And sort of a companion to that, are we forced into a situation that if we believe one side or accept one side, what does that say about our views of the other side? If I believe in evolution, what does that say about my belief in a God? Banning evolution versus inclusion, the Balanced Treatment Act. What do we mean by that? And whether or not, I go back to the same sort of thing, those things can coexist. Is evolution a theory or a fact? And if it is not a fact, what does that also mean? I'm intrigued by the whole concept of intelligent design and how close is that to creationism, or is there really a difference there? What's wrong with having an open mind? What's so bad about that? What about the Constitution? And really, are we really treading on it, or is this one of those allowable sort of exceptions in it when we talk about religion and the government? Can you teach it if you want? And this is a real interesting question to me. When we start to look at this and I listen to the debates, and what I've tried to do is have a very open mind as I listen to everything and think about this, are we at a point where we're saying you have to teach something, or are we still at a point you can teach something? The right to do something is very different than the requirement to do something. And then finally, I would pose this in all of that. What do we mean by public when we say public education? Who decides what is going to be included in the public education? Thank you. Do we have time for questions?
I think in fairness to the performers, we ought to turn the stage over to them as we have run late with the start of our show. So we thank you very much for coming early and listening to the issue of evolution and religion, or science and religion, evolution and intelligent design as a precursor to sort of traveling back to a very real starting point, a concrete episode in our history. So with that, I'd like to say thank you and turn things over to the performance that you've come here to see.